Lecture 9, A Peculiar Institution, Hoplite Warfare.
For this and the next 7 lectures, we turn our attention to what has been a growth area in ancient military studies in recent decades, Greek warfare. Many clashes are ongoing in this dynamic scholarly battlefield, but 3 concern us in this lecture. First, the transition to hoplite mode of warfare in the 8th and 7th centuries BC, then the mechanics of hoplite battle, and finally, the proposition that classical Greek warfare displays unique characteristics that stand at the root of a peculiarly Western way of war. We saw in Lecture 6 that the Homeric epics are thought in many quarters to portray a distinct style of combat that was practiced to about 700 BC. After that date, a new warrior appeared on the Greek battlefield. He was called hoplites, hoplite in English, after the Greek word hopla, which means equipment or tools. So hoplite denotes something like the man in gear or the equipped man. The defining feature of the hoplite's equipment was his shield. It was termed an aspis rather than a hoplon, as is sometimes wrongly asserted in books. The hoplite shield was round and concave, usually about 1 meter in diameter, and was made of heavy wood, rimmed with, and sometimes faced with, bronze, and it was carried in a very special way. Earlier shields, such as those carried by Homer's heroes, had a central hand grip or were slung over the shoulder with straps. The hoplite, however, put his arm through a hoop at the shield's centre, called a porpax, and gripped a handle at the rim, called the antilabe. So the shield's weight, up to about 20 pounds if it was faced entirely with bronze, was borne by the forearm rather than by the wrist or by the shoulders. Hoplites wore bronze helmets, the most popular being the fearsome-looking Corinthian type, which completely enclosed the head and allowed sight and breathing only through a narrow, T-shaped opening at the front. A man wearing such a helmet had his hearing and peripheral vision greatly impaired. Bronze, or later linen corslets, encased the hoplite's chest, back and abdomen, and greaves protected his shins below the knee. Other pieces of armour could be applied to the forearms, ankles and feet, and sometimes a leather blanket was suspended from the shield, but these were optional features since the hoplite really provided his own equipment and so much depended on how much he could afford to buy. The hoplite's main offensive weapon was a stabbing spear about 8 feet long and equipped with an iron head at the business end, if you like, and a bronze spike at the other end. A short sword was carried as a secondary weapon. Hoplites fought in the tight formation called a phalanx, which seems to be derived from the Greek word for log. In the phalanx, the men were arrayed in ranks that ran laterally down the length of the phalanx, and files, which ran from front to back. The phalanx was normally 8 ranks deep, but the number of files would depend on how many men were available for muster. It is immediately obvious that a phalanx of heavy infantrymen stands in stark contrast to the sort of open-order fighting characteristic of the Homeric battlefield, or that shown on the Dipylon pots from Athens, dated to about 750 to 725 BC. The Dipylon warriors, it will be remembered, were armed with javelins, spears, swords, and bows, and used chariots, from which they apparently dismounted to fight on foot. Their distinctive shields resemble apple cores in silhouette and bear no resemblance to the heavy, concave, and round hoplite shield. Models of Dipylon shields show that they were carried with a central hand grip or were strapped over the shoulders. Indeed, the equipment of the Dipylon warrior is largely consonant with the supposed Homeric mode of combat marked by high mobility and plenty of missile action. Yet by 650 BC, a pot in the Corinthian style, the so-called Chigi vase, found in an Etruscan burial in Italy, shows hoplite warriors with their distinctive double-grip shields, bronze breastplates, greaves, and head-encasing helmets. They seem arrayed in the tight phalanx, at least insofar as a pot painter can depict such a formation. Clearly, Greek combat methods had changed between the Dipylon pots and the Chigi vase. How had this happened, and why? Until quite recently, 2 views dominated this debate. The first was the gradualist position. It saw hoplite equipment adopted piecemeal over a protracted period. There was evidence of a transitional stage between full Homeric and full hoplite warfare. Thus, for instance, the Spartan poet Tyrtaeus, writing around 650 to 625 BC, mentions archers and stone throwers intermingled with armor warriors in tight formation, a thing unheard of in the fully developed hoplite phalanx. Archaeology offered clues as well. A panoply from a burial at Argos dated to about 720 BC comprised a bronze breastplate and a rather Assyrian-looking conical helmet. Unfortunately, no shield was found to clinch the identification of the warrior as a hoplite. The equipment could equally be that of a bronze-clad Homeric Promachos, or fighter out front. Other finds of armour, unfortunately, are less useful. It was customary to dedicate suits of armour to the gods at sanctuaries like the one at Olympia. These dedications could so clutter the place that they were occasionally gathered up and dumped. But while useful in preserving much Greek armour, such deposits present us with a jumble of elements from different eras all thrown together into a single pit. This limits the conclusions that can be drawn from them about warfare in particular periods. Nevertheless, the physical evidence, claim the people who support the gradual view, generally supported a piecemeal transition to hoplites spanning a period of perhaps 150 years or more, ending by about 600 BC. The second view took precisely the opposite tack. The emergence of hoplites was sudden, spanning perhaps 50 or at most 75 years between about 725 and 650 BC. The first date represents the last depictions of Dipylon warriors, and the second represents the appearance of hoplites on the Kiji Vaz. Once the hoplite phalanx made its appearance, goes this line of argument, everyone either had to adopt the new techniques rapidly or face defeat on the field of battle. Therefore, this form of fighting appeared and spread quickly throughout mainland Greece, with formation and equipment arriving more or less concurrently. Arguments about the double grip of the hoplite shield are emblematic of how this debate played out. The proponents of a sudden change pointed out that this shield, heavy, difficult to manoeuvre, lacking a shoulder strap, and gripped in such a way that its left half offered little or no protection to its wielder, such a shield was not suited to the hit-and-run tactics of the Homeric or Dipylon open-cast battlefield. Hoplites, in fact, jettisoned their shields when taking flight, since it was such an encumbrance. So why would a Homeric-style fighter pay for an expensive piece of equipment if it could get him killed or had to be thrown away when he decided to retreat from the front? No, the hoplite shield was inherently linked to the massed formation of the phalanx, since the apparently useless left half would cover the right side of the neighbouring hoplite in the phalanx. All this implies that the shield and the phalanx showed up more or less at once, and that we are dealing with a sudden revolution in military methods, not a gradual transition. The gradualist responded that the hoplite shield was far more manoeuvrable than the limited imaginations of the sudden changers allowed. They pointed out that routed soldiers are not in the same situation as soldiers moving about in an open order form of combat. And they also said similar double grips are found in some Roman and medieval shields where they did not require a phalanx to be useful. There was therefore no inherent link between the double grip shield and the phalanx, and the transition therefore did not have to be a sudden one. In general, major socio-political changes were also ongoing in Greek city-states at this same time period, between about 750 and 650 BC. For instance, there was a shift away from monarchies to oligarchies, or rule by a few, backed by popular assemblies of adult male citizens. And in some places, revolutions brought forth strong men termed tyrants, who seized power by force. We would call them, I suppose, military dictators today. Scholars have long wondered whether there was a connection between these sorts of developments and the contemporary transformation of Greek military techniques. Everyone was agreed that the phalanx implied a greater general wealth among the Greeks, since now small farmers could afford the sort of expensive equipment that had previously been the preserve of the Homeric Promachoi. One suggestion was that the appearance of tyrants at this time was directly tied to the emergence of the new hoplite class, so-called, here exercising their political muscle at the expense of the formerly dominant aristocrats. Marxist historians offered a very different view. Hoplite warfare was nothing other than a grand scheme by an expanding elite to exclude those who could not afford the expense of hoplite equipment from the prestige and influence of military service. The adoption of hoplite warfare was thus a form of class warfare, aimed not at undermining aristocratic privilege, but at protecting it in times of change. And so the debate rolled on, detailed, technical, wide-ranging and multifaceted. Recent opinion, however, is much more diverse. As we saw in Lecture 6, an influential view today is that massed rank warfare is already identifiable in Homer. In fact, goes this argument, Homeric massed rank combat is nothing other than the hoplite phalanx. So there was no hoplite reform as such, since there was no definite Homeric style of combat to reform in the first place. And naturally, there can have been no socio-political consequences for something that did not happen. The greatest weakness of this position we have already seen in Lecture 6, namely, it generalizes massed rank action depicted in Homer as occasional rallies of hard-pressed troops into the standard hoplite formation of the phalanx, which was adapted on entering battle and sustained throughout the fighting. This is not at all how Homeric battles actually play out. Another position, championed by Hans van Wees, agrees that hoplites are identifiable in Homer, but only up to a point. Homeric warriors are not fully developed hoplites, but transitional prototypes. There is no mention, for instance, in Homer, of the double-grip shield. The Kiji Vaz portrays not a full hoplite phalanx, but a transitional one. The warriors carry javelins, for instance, as well as a stabbing spear, and the fully developed hoplite did not use javelins. This echoes other 7th century evidence, such as Tyrtaeus, who, as we just saw, has archers and stone throwers mingled into the ranks. So the process of transition to the fully fledged phalanx was not complete even by the mid to late 7th century BC. Since Homer's battle descriptions are consistent with so much 7th century evidence, van Wees then takes the next logical step and redates Homer himself to the 7th century. Accepting this view allows a hoplite reform of sorts, but now the nature of pre-hoplite warfare becomes very indistinct, since a later Homer already describes a transitional form of hoplite battle. Victor Davis Hanson takes a different position still. He insists that the sudden change view is more or less correct, and that on the basis of military considerations, the shield and other elements of the hoplite equipment require the existence of a phalanx. On this model, proto-phalanxes in Homer were elaborated into full phalanxes in the period around 750 to 675 BC, as more and more small farmers became prosperous enough to join the battle line. The full hoplite panoply rapidly appeared to fit this new tactical situation. In all of this, the socio-political consequences of the changeover to hoplite battle have been radically reconsidered. A common view today, in fact, is that the appearance of hoplites reflected rather than caused the political and social changes that were already underway in Greek states for entirely non-military reasons, perhaps linked, for instance, to changing patterns of land ownership. In sum, then, the issue of the hoplite reform, despite decades of scholarly debate, remains today very unsettled. Some hold it to have been a sudden process, others a slow process, and some question whether it ever took place at all. What is clear, however, is that by 600 BC, a phalanx of heavily armored hoplites was the standard mode of land combat across mainland Greece. The nature of such engagements is the next topic for our consideration. What was hoplite battle like? The dominant view today stresses the ritualized nature and physical intensity of hoplite warfare. To an extent, all battle is ritualized in the sense that rules, spoken or unspoken, give cultural structure and meaning to battles. These rules will usually be gleaned from the wider context within which soldiers live as well as fight and die. In the case of the Greeks, battle has been tied to the culture of competition that prevailed among Greek males and is often termed the agon, or the struggle or competition. The agon is most clearly found in the periodic athletic competitions at places like Olympia, Nemea, and Delphi, to which all Greek states sent representatives. These festivals usually superseded warfare. Truces were declared to allow champions, who were often impressive warriors as well, to pass through hostile territory unharmed en route to the festival. The agon pervaded the Greek male ethos, and warfare ranks alongside the athletic festival, popular assembly, or the courts, as just another arena for its prosecution. This approach shapes the views or the interpretations of what actually happened when phalanxes collided. The Greek sources, it must be said, are laconic on these details, presumably because they assumed most of their readers would know what happened in a phalanx battle, since many of them would have experienced it. Now, about the fullest account of a hoplite combat that we get is in Xenophon, and his description of the Battle of Chaeronea in 394 BC between the Spartans and the Thebans. The Spartans, writes Xenophon, crashed into the Theban army head-on, and as they threw shield against shield, they pushed, they fought, they killed, they died. Other sources speak of a huge noise and spears shattering, and men exhorted to stand their ground and not yield an inch. The emphasis is on holding the line, keeping cohesion, and pushing. Now, the standard view of hoplite battle mechanics takes such statements as literally descriptive. Greek hoplites advanced shoulder to shoulder in close, ordered formation and crashed into each other head-on in this same formation. Then they sought, quite literally, to shove their opponents off the field, all the while stabbing with their spears. Since hoplites were well armoured and carried large shields, most wounds were incurred in the throat or in the groin, that is to say, above the shield or under it. Victory was achieved by a push, termed orthismos in Greek, that saw the opposing phalanxes heaving against each other, trying to shove the enemy backwards. When one side succumbed to the intense pressure of shoving and ran, the battle was over. This model neatly explains why phalanxes were 8 ranks or more deep. The rear ranks added their weight, literally their physical weight, to the push of the orthismos, shoving with their shields into the backs of the men in front of them. Further, as the winning phalanx rolled over fallen enemy hoplites, the rear ranks would stab downwards with the bronze butt spikes of their spears and finish off the wounded, hence the reason for the butt spikes. Now, these unusual battle conditions are also invoked to explain why Greek hoplite values shunned individual displays of bravery and emphasized collective effort, steadfastness, and maintaining formation. This model is immensely popular today and is now often cited as established fact in general works on ancient warfare. But it has its critics. The arguments are technical and detailed, and I outline a few here as exemplars. 8 ranks of men standing shoulder to shoulder and pushing with all their might against an opposing 8 ranks of men who were also pushing with all their might is, to put it mildly, a little implausible. How could the front ranks retain their footing, let alone use their weapons, in such a scenario? Would not the front ranks be pushed upwards into a sort of human pyramid? References to such things as the clash of shields, the shattering of spears, the great noise of impact, or the closeness of opponents do not require mass scrimmaging of the type required by the standard view. These things will occur quite naturally when large bodies of armoured men collide on the battlefield. Such allusions also have the advantage of echoing Homer, the Greek warrior's holy Bible. Further, the appearance of the word orthismos in ancient Greek battle narratives does not necessitate a physical mass shove by opposing ranks of densely packed hoplites. It may denote individual acts of pushing with shields to topple opponents over, rather than a mass joint shove. And we know that the word orthismos was used figuratively in Greek as it is today, in the sense of to push the enemy back or the big push is coming. Greek authors use orthismos in reference to the cut and thrust of rhetorical argument, where clearly a mass physical shove is out of the question. Ancient depictions of hoplites in battle, mostly on painted pots, do not support the standard view. We do not see mass shoving or densely packed men. What we do see are men fighting with spears and swords, their shields held out at an angle in front of them. Further, most Greek battle narratives are noticeably vague in their terminology and cannot be used to support the singular picture of Greek warfare proffered by the standard view. A classic example is Thucydides' comment that a phalanx moving into battle generally edges to the right, since each man thinks, as one modern translation has it, and I quote, that the more closely the shields are locked together, the safer he will be, unquote. So as the man on the extreme right shies his exposed side away from the enemy, he drags the whole phalanx with him. This comment seems to offer unequivocal support for the standard view. We have shields locked together for protection and density of formation. But problems emerge under closer scrutiny. First, Thucydides says that this formation was adopted on the advance, not necessarily when battle was actually joined. Indeed, things usually got very unclear once the fighting starts, and we can expect formations to begin to fall apart rather rapidly as the confusion of battle spreads. Second, Thucydides' wording is actually much vaguer than the translation cited above suggests. Translated literally, the phrase says, and I quote, that the men, edge to the right, quote, thinking that the denser their closeness is, the better protected they are. There is no mention of lock shields in the Greek at all. Other questions then arise from this wording. What is meant exactly by the denser their closeness is? What did close mean to a Greek hoplite anyway? We can't say, since Thucydides assumes a basic knowledge of hoplite battle conditions that we do not possess. As I say, these are only some examples of the sort of objections to the standard view, but there are many others that seriously undermine the notion of agonistic, ritualized, mass shoving of densely packed ranks. In its stead, critics offer their own versions of hoplite battle, not all of them mutually compatible. Some favor phases, that is to say, a close-ordered advance and impact, then open-order weapons play, then once more close-ordered shoving at the end to end the contest. But how were such phases orchestrated? How did the hoplites know when to open up and when to close up again? Greek sources are consistent in stressing the indispensability of maintaining cohesion in the face of the enemy. Would not a mistimed opening of the ranks invite instant defeat? On the basis of considerations like these, the phased battle model has very few supporters. Another suggestion is that hoplite battle was generally more open-ordered than is usually envisioned, though less so than the supposed Homeric style of warfare. Hoplites did not stand shoulder to shoulder literally, but rather up to 6 feet apart, as later Roman legionaries were to do. This allowed the wielding of weapons for which we know Greek hoplites trained individually. Other features of hoplite engagements, such as the shift from an overarm to an underarm spear grip, the removal of the dead and wounded comrades from the front, can be accommodated in this model, but they do not fit neatly within the standard view of the tightly packed shove. In tight spots, the formation might indeed close up, but this was not a predetermined phase, it was a reaction to immediate threats. On this model, the object of hoplite battle was not to push the enemy off the field with a mass shove, but rather to fight one's way into the opposing formation and break it up. The function of the rearward ranks, then, was not to shove, but to stiffen resistance against such attempted infiltration. The greater the number of ranks that the opponent had to fight his way through, the greater psychological disadvantage he fought at. Contrary to widespread opinion, individual hoplites were praised for displays of bravery. The battle narratives of Herodotus, for instance, consistently end by naming men who had earned particular kudos for their battlefield exploits, although to be fair, the Greeks in this instance were fighting non-hoplite Persian armies. To be sure, open-order battle is the minority view among Greek military historians today. But it seems to me it has a lot more going for it and is a lot more plausible and is supported by the ancient evidence better than the strange business of ritualized shoving proposed by the standard scenario. Finally, we turn to the equally widespread notion that the Greeks invented a peculiarly Western way of war, the main features of which were as follows. First, with hoplites, the Greeks relied exclusively on heavy infantry to decide their battles. Down to the Peloponnesian War, fought between 431 and 404 BC, they disdained light-armed infantry, cavalry, chariots, archers, and other missile troops. They relied wholly on a clash of hoplites to get a result. Next, hoplite warfare was conducted face-to-face, at close quarters and openly, insofar as deceit, ambushes, ruses, and the like were eschewed. The fight had to be as clean as it was brutal for a genuine winner to emerge. This is consonant with the wider Greek ethos of the agon. That hoplites were small farmers who did not want to be away from their land for long periods meant that everyone involved had a vested interest in reaching a decision as quickly as possible. So there emerged a unique emphasis on the quick, decisive engagement in the open field. Hoplite warfare was limited to these brief periods of intense brutality. Rather than aiming at wholesale conquest or the subjugation and incorporation of the loser's territory, warfare was merely a way of settling a dispute. From this raw material goes the argument, the Greeks developed a model of warfare that, for the first time in history, made the decisive pitched battle the only valued form of engagement. This view insists that decisive battle was not a major concern among Egyptians or among Near Easterners, who laid greater emphasis on deceit, ambush, outflanking and encircling maneuvers, and winning without a fight. Near Eastern armies were also made up of conscript peasantry serving a despot, very unlike the Greek hoplite, who was a free smallholder, a citizen with a stake in his polity, and a voluntary member of a citizen militia. Greek hoplite citizens voted themselves into battle. Asiatic peasant conscripts were whipped into the front on the orders of a despot. This peculiar institution of hoplite battle is held to stand at the root of a Western way of war that continues down to this day. Westerners seek out the enemy and want to defeat him in an honest fight, where the maximum force is brought to bear in the decisive, brutal engagement. Other cultures often seek to avoid battle altogether, or place a premium on ambushes or ruses in their military practice. Such is the view. This model, however, which is immensely popular today, has, in my opinion, very severe deficiencies. In the first place, we've seen that decisive battles were prized, even sought after, by Egyptians, Asiatics, Hittites, and Assyrians. Settling disputes in full-on engagements was not a Greek invention. More troubling still is the matter of the evidence used to support the Western way of war model. The Greek devotion to hoplite-only battles is said to pertain to the archaic era of Greek history, that stretching roughly from 700 to 500 BC. Yet most of our evidence for what Greek battles were like comes from the later classical period, from writers like Thucydides writing in the 5th century, or Xenophon in the 4th, or from even later writers, such as Polybius, writing in the 2nd century BC. In these later eras, the use of archers, missile troops, light-armed infantry, and cavalry units was standard practice in Greek warfare. For the supposedly hoplite-only period, prior to the 5th century, we have only scraps and allusions, and not a single complete description of a contemporary battle. This is a huge problem for the standard model, since it is forced then to operate, essentially, in an evidence vacuum, which it fills in with bits and pieces of later testimony derived from ages which, on the whole, do not conform to the hoplite-only model. There is therefore a worrisome degree of selectivity in the presentation of the standard model. Let me illustrate the point. Two passages are often cited in support of the standard model for archaic Greek warfare. One is a passage in Herodotus, where the Persian general Mardonius informs his king Xerxes, and I quote, "Besides, from all I hear, the Greeks usually wage war in an extremely stupid fashion, because they're ignorant and incompetent. When they declare war on one another, they seek out the best, most level piece of land, and that's where they go and fight. The upshot is that the victors leave the battlefield with massive losses, not to mention the losers, who are completely wiped out. What they should do, since they all speak the same language, is make use of heralds and messengers to settle their differences, since anything would be preferable to fighting. If they had absolutely no choice but to go to war, they should find a battleground where it is particularly hard for either side to defeat the other and fight it out there." End quote. This passage offers apparently terrific support for the standard model, from the agonistic mode of Greek warfare right down to the Eastern aversion to head-on battle and seeking victory without a fight. But context is vital here. This is not Herodotus laying out the raw facts. Rather, this is an opinion voiced by a leading Persian courtier on the eve of the great Persian invasion of Greece in 480 BC. Now, Mardonius was to command the Persian forces at the Battle of Plataea at the end of that invasion, as we shall see in Lecture 12. Given that Mardonius lost both the fight and his life at Plataea, there must be a suspicion of irony, perhaps even parody, in the presentation of his opinion here. Mardonius is going to be defeated and indeed killed by the very system of warfare he is here denigrating, and which, it seems to me, he grossly distorts. He goes on to say, "The Greeks go about things in the wrong way." I, for one, can imagine Herodotus' Greek audience laughing at their barbarians' foolish judgment, a judgment they knew would cost him his life at the hands of a mode of combat he clearly did not understand. As if that weren't enough, Herodotus has another Persian courtier named Artabanus speak immediately after Mardonius. Artabanus warns the king not to underestimate the Greeks. He specifically brands Mardonius' portrayal of Greek warfare foolish and misleading. Given this context, it seems to me highly dubious to invoke Mardonius' opinion as hard evidence for hundreds of years of Greek military practice. Another passage, this time in Polybius, writing in the 2nd century BC, has also had much heavy lifting asked of it. Writes Polybius, and I quote, "The ancients chose not to conquer their enemies by deception, regarding no success as brilliant or secure unless they crushed their adversary's spirit in open battle. For this reason, they agreed with each other not to use hidden missiles or those discharged from a distance against each other, and they considered only a hand-to-hand pitched battle to be truly decisive. Therefore, they declared wars and battles in advance, announcing when and where they were going to deploy. But now, they say only a poor general does anything openly in war. Unquote. Once more, this seems to offer corroboration for the standard model. There is rejection of deception and the use of missile troops on principle, and a commitment to open pitched battles at close quarters as the only valued mode of engagement. But once again, can we take the passage at face value? Does it not have a distinct whiff of nostalgia about it? Would we accept uncritically other statements about how much more honourable things were in the good old days? In any case, who were the ancients to Polybius's way of thinking? When were they around? Do we know for sure that he had the mainland Greeks of the Archaic era in mind when he wrote those words? The standard model is really far more problematic than is often presented. Having acquainted ourselves then with these generalities, it is now time to turn to specific engagements. We begin with an imperiled Athens, fighting for her life against the largest empire the world had seen to date.